Ministry time to try to finish those that would help bring the gospel to the Kurds and the Persians, which are many, probably what, if there's 15 million Kurds and probably 40 to 50 million Persians, that's maybe over 50, 60, 70 million people that are targeted with this book that explains the history of their background, the sacred history of them. It's called Children of the Magi, A Sacred History of the Kurds and the Persians. And so Kenny and Juan said, we believe you should take up to a half your time for the next few months to finish this book. And so I did. You pay my salary, right? So I had the liberty, because of my two brothers, saying, take this time. It's going to be Gateway's gift to this part of the world, to these people who are really in darkness. If you think about Iran, if you think about Iraq, if you think about southeastern Turkey, these are where they live, right? And right in the heart of the Middle East and a lot of the conflict areas. ISIS was attacking the Kurds, you know, in the last two or three years. And so I spent probably, I think maybe 6 months and probably 7 to 10 hours a week. Based on your gracious support of my income, I was able to finish this book. And so what we have today is 25 copies of this book, and they're for you. They're free because you are the one who, through your gifts, enabled this book to be done. And so today what I'm giving you is a sermon with some of the graphic images from some of the maps and things that I have in the book I'm putting up on the screen today to help you understand who the Magi were and why. You know, it's so sad that in the churches today, so many stories in Scripture are basically like legends. They're treated like legends that we know they're true, but we really don't know where it happened, who was there, and stuff like that. And I want to deconstruct the legend of three wise men, one African-American, you know, Melchior and Casper and whatever the person's, you know, those are all traditions that came much later. I want you to see what actually who the Magi are, the Manji people, the tribe of the Medes who lived 2,600 years ago, and then where they are today, and why it is that they were able to find their way all the way to Bethlehem. And so I want to see, let's see, I think I have right here, this is a picture of an Afghan man, but he's related to what the Magi look, the Kurds look just like this man. They have a turban. When I was in North Iraq for about 3 weeks after the 91 Persian Gulf War, we set up a tent, a hospital that we could handle. We had 9 doctors from the UN that were there, and we ran a clinic for these people that came back, these refugees that came back from the mountains of Turkey to come back into Iraq. And at this point, Papa Bush, not young Bush, but George Bush Sr., had drawn a line saying no fly zone. And so Saddam could not send any planes above the 38th parallel or whatever it was. And then that was when I got there, April 91. And when we were there, I stayed there about 3 weeks, or 2 or 3 weeks, and while I was there, once the situation got a little bit more, we got a handle on it, helping these patients, because we had up to 400 patients a day, mostly little babies that were dehydrated and trying to save their lives. And when I was there, I went into downtown, and I found a tailor who makes these what do they call them, shalwar? I'm not sure what they call them, but they it's basically the Kurdish suit of the top and these big, wide, baggy pants, and then a cummerbund that goes on the top, and then a turban, and that's how they were dressed, and that's how I dressed myself every day. I would put on my Kurdish dress, and then later on, I kept it, but I don't know, somewhere in our garage right now. But it was kind of fun to dress like them, even though I didn't know their language yet, just to feel like I was a Kurdish man. So here's a picture of Kurds from 1891 or so, 1870, somewhere in the, near the turn of the century. It was taken by Pascal somebody in Istanbul. And the man on the left, you see him with his big draped, this is basically the skin of sheep that he sewed together to make a coat. And this is a very traditional Kurdish shepherd's outfit. They put a stick in the back to hold it up over their shoulders, and then they have a hood. And with that, they can sleep out at night when it gets to be 30 degrees outside and they're taking, you know, very cold, and they take their sheep out in the hills of the Anatolia. And that's exactly how they dressed, even to this day. So I've seen some that still have that. Some of the most eastern provinces, not in the center of Anatolia, but in the east, they still dress like that. And then the man in the middle, so that man is from Diyarbakir. The man in the middle, I think, is from Mardin, and the man on the side is from Cizre. There's three cities. And believe it or not, the Cizre, the word Cizre means grave, and it's the site where Noah was buried. So what happens, I mean, people don't think in America, like, Noah, well, yeah, we knew he lived long ago. There's actually a grave site. There's a tomb in Cizre that's Nuhun to... Can I see? What's the word? I can't remember. the Turkish word for it. But anyway, it's his grave, and people go there. Of course, a lot of Muslims go there because they believe in Noah was a prophet, and of course, he was the, you know, after the flood, they know that story. But it's not very far from Mount Ararat. It's where the people would have wandered from Mount Ararat towards Iraq, and that's where he stopped and apparently passed away there. So I want to show you with these pictures and with the stories and with the biblical narratives, I want to give you a picture of what actually happened leading up to the events of Christ's birth. Because 600 years before Christ was born, Daniel was brought to this people group of the Medes and the Persians, which are today's Kurds and Iranians. Okay, so the Medes and the Persians, which you hear in the book of Daniel and also in the book of Esther, the Medes and the Persians today are the Kurds and Iranians. Okay, let me read to you here. This is what Moses said in Genesis. Now, this is the history of the generations of the sons of Noah and of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Noah had three sons, and as I've said before, we have three kinds of people today, black, white, yellow. Maybe that's not a coincidence. Sons were born to them after the flood. And it says the sons of Japheth became the father of the Indo-European races or the Indo-European peoples. So all the way from Ireland to Bangladesh, if you take a big swath of humanity, that is all the sons of Japheth. And it says the sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Yavan, Tubal, Meshech, Tiraz. And if I had time, I could explain to which these men and where their descendants all moved to Europe and towards Russia, north and stuff like that. Like we still have, we have Meshech and Tiraz, or Tubal and Meshech are today perhaps related to Moscow and Tobolsk, you know, the two major cities in Russia. But the father of the Medes is Madai. It says here the third name is Gomer Magog Madai. And Madai and his descendants stayed. Oh, let me see if the next one has a map here. I'll have to show it later. Anyway, Madai and his descendants, they stayed in the area of Mount Ararat and the Zagros Mountains where Enrique spent a lot of time. The Zagros Mountains are the mountains that border Iran and Iraq. And so they've lived there for thousands of years. They never moved. It's as if the other brothers and their descendants said, well, we're going to keep going down these rivers until we find some more fertile land. And the sons of Madai said, well, we like it here. We don't have to do any irrigation. We're just going to do normal dry farming, and you do the irrigation farming, and we'll stay here in the mountains where it rains more and raise our animals. And so the Madai, the Medes, became people who were not so well educated. They didn't have a very sophisticated civilization. They were always into animal husbandry and into growing crops that are in the mountains. So they always stayed away from everything else that happened in the world. And one of the sad parts is that their language was not documented like Arabic or Hebrew or Sanskrit or, you know, some of the other languages, all the European languages. We have beautiful texts that go way back. But in terms of the Medes and the Kurds, we have no texts that go back 3,000 years, 2,000, not even 1,000 years. There's nothing. They just lived in the mountains and they knew how to talk well, but they didn't have any literary background. So that's one of the things that's just interesting. Even though their language is one of the oldest languages on earth, and their language, Sorani, their dialect of Sorani, is so close to Hebrew that when you take the numbers 1 through 10 in Sorani and the numbers 1 through 10 in Hebrew, there are 6 cognates among the 10 words. Because Hebrew is one of the earliest Afro-Asiatic languages going south, and Sorani Kurdish is one of the earliest Indo-European languages going west and southeast. So in Genesis 10, we hear about Madai being the father then of the Medes, and from him all the way across from you'll see up there on the top, maybe you can't, I don't know if it's big enough to see the words, but it's Kurmanji, then it's Farsi, then it's, I can't see from here either. I knew this might happen to me. I should have used a bigger font. But anyway, you have Kashmiri, you have Hindi, you have Nepali, and finally Bengali. All these languages, if you looked at the numbers 1 through 10, they're all related. I can give you one of them. That's Kurdish. It goes, Yek, Tu, Se, Chor, Bench, Shesh, Haft, Hasht, Ne, Da. And when I'm at Glendale and I say those numbers 1 through 10, they all go, oh, we know those numbers. That's just like Farsi. And if someone's from, I had a girl from Bangladesh. She goes, oh, I recognize those numbers. They're just like our Bengali. Well, they are because they're all related. And I believe that the sons of Madai, they started in the Zagros Mountains and they went eastward past the Indus River all the way into Bangladesh. And then the Himalayans prevented them from having much contact with the Asian Mongolian peoples north of them. And that's why you have the Chinese and all the, you know, Kazakh and Uyghur and Uzbek and Turkmen. And the Mongolian peoples, they all stayed north of the Himalayas, and the Indo-Europeans stayed south of the Himalayas all the way to Bangladesh. And then after Bangladesh comes Burma or Myanmar, and there it changes completely. People are Asian. Suddenly you see the features, the Asian features. So anyway, the thing I want to share about this, though, I think maybe the next one is another map. No, this is, oh, this is a city of Diyarbakir where Karen and I lived for 2 years. This is on the Tigris River. So if you go back here, you'll see that, you can't see there, but anyway, the Persian Gulf, right above the Persian Gulf are two rivers, the Euphrates on the left side and the Tigris on the right side, and that is the area known as Mesopotamia. So this here, I took this picture myself of in wintertime in Diyarbakir. This is a city, that wall that's built there is 42 feet high. It is built out of basalt, black basalt, and it was built 1,700 years ago by Constantine. Think about that. These walls are still standing from 1,700 years before. And Constantine, the city used to be called Amida, like the word Medes, Amida, like Madai, you know. So whenever the children of one particular man, the patriarch, would move, they would often call their city after their patriarch, right? Well, we're the sons of Madai, so we're going to call this Amida or Amada. In fact, it may have been called Madai one time, but they added the A later on. And so this is the ancient city of Amida. Today it's Diyarbakir. There's about 2 million people that live there. And Karen and I were about 20 minutes walk from this big, huge gate that opened up. That has a big door. The door is centuries old, I think. And that door would close all the way up to, I think it's 1951 or 1954. They still closed it every night at 5:30 so that no one could get in from the outside, and they would keep everyone safe inside the city. It's amazing. So just to show you that, and sadly, they don't have any rails on this thing. So, you know, every year someone falls off the thing because all these kids go up there and they want to look at the view and they dangle their feet from 42 feet high, and then someone is like, hey, look at this, bing! And often they die. Yours truly. One time I took a tour group and I said, oh, let's go up there. And I walked in and I realized, what am I doing? There's no safety here. I felt one of those typical crisscross mistakes. But anyway, no one died, fortunately. Okay, so just one more thing that's important about the Medes. So they lived in these Zagros Mountains. They lived on the Tigris and near the Euphrates when they came together there in Mesopotamia. And it was about 700 B.C., when you remember Israel, the nation, all the tribes that moved, King David lived about 1,000 B.C., so about 300 years after David, what happened was the people got involved in idolatry, and especially the northern tribes, the northern 10 tribes, Zebulun, Naphtali, so forth, they became more and more idolatrous. And so God warned them through the prophets, Elijah, Elisha, all these prophets, saying, I'm telling you, you're going to be taken and deported from this place. God will take you and remove you from this promised land that he gave you because you are no longer worshiping him. And if you do this, you're going to be taken to the east, to the northeast. They actually knew the area that they would be taken, and they warned them about the king Sennacherib, and finally the day came. And this is what it says in the, I think it's in Chronicles. No, 2 Kings 17. It gives the little story of when this happened. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hoshea, the Jewish king of the northern tribes, he became his servant and brought him tribute, meaning paying his taxes year by year. The king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to a man named So, King So in Egypt, and offered no tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. So what he did is Hoshea thought, hey, if I rebel against Syria, I can't do it alone. But if I get support from Egypt, they'll help me with their soldiers and I'll fight against them and we'll be able to be, we don't have to pay taxes anymore. We'll be free. Therefore, the king of Assyria seized him and bound him in prison. Then the king of Assyria came up throughout the land, all the land, went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. That's how long it takes to starve the people because they have so many goods in that city. And once the city walls close, you can't get in. So all they can do is wait there. Literally wait for 3 years until the people run out of food, and then they can take it. So it lasted 3 years. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Hala on the Habor and the river Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. So what did he do? I think I have a map here. He took them away from Israel and walked them, make them march all the way up to these two rivers, the Euphrates on one, well, the Khabur is a small tributary from that goes into the Euphrates, and then all the way there to the Tigris, where I lived in Diyarbakir. He took them all the way to the cities of the Medes. And why am I saying this? Why is this important? It's because what happened after that is the people, all these 10 tribes, he did not take, 120 people, like the top royalty. He took everybody. He took tens of thousands of Israelis, Jewish people, not Judah and not Benjamin, but the northern 10 tribes. He took them, made them go into the cities of the Medes and this area. And so what happened over the years is they intermarried. So now you have Kurds or ancient Medes intermarrying with Jewish blood and finding out something more about the Mosaic Law and something about Abraham and their history and their faith. Even though they were idolatrous, they still knew the stories about their faith. And so you end up with a half-breed of people that by the time Jesus was born, you had this thing called Samaritans, right? So Samaritans were from this area of the Medes. They were mixed with Persian blood. And then they came back after Cyrus gave them permission to come back. Well, they were no longer purebreds anymore. They weren't pure. They weren't just Jewish. They were Jewish / Persian. And the kids didn't even know Hebrew anymore. They knew Aramaic, the language from up there. So when Jesus grew up in Galilee, he spoke Aramaic. He learned Hebrew in the synagogue, which was the original language of the Jews. But he actually grew up speaking the northern dialect, which is the half-breed. It's a Gentile language, Aramaic. But that's what God did because of their sin. So what happened was I thought, I'm going to find out if there's any evidence at all because of the Kurds today having Jewish DNA. And you know, with the DNA testing, in just the last 10 years, they can do this, right? So I looked up, bingo, I found something. In 2001, researchers at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem published an article in the American Journal of Human Genetics claiming, quote, in comparison with data available from other relevant populations in the region, Jews were found to be more closely related to the groups in the north of the Fertile Crescent, the Kurds, and the Turks and the Armenians, than to their Arab neighbors. Now that is significant. Because they said, wait a minute, this DNA, because they can trace back and find out who has the common ancestors, and they can see, now wait a minute, all the Arabs, we know for a fact that they came from whom? Abraham, Ishmael, right? All the Jews came from Abraham, Isaac, right? Isaac had Jacob. Jacob had the 12 tribes, and that's the Jewish nation right there. Starting with Jacob, you have pure Jews, right? But with Abraham, you could have had an Arab, right? If it's go through Ishmael. And Ishmael had 12 sons, so he had a big population too, the Arab population. But we know that if you look at an Arab and if you look at a Jew, you say, well, both of them share the same grandfather in Abraham. But what the university says, but wait a minute, the Kurds share a father much, much later. They share Jacob as a father. Maybe even Benjamin and Judah and some of the 12. They are pure, they are part Jewish. They're closer in their genetic disposition to the Jewish people in Israel than that Palestinian Arabs are, the ones that are closest in proximity to them. So I did a little graph in the book showing the Kurds and the Persians. Do you realize that you have Jewish blood in you? Because when I was there in Diyarbakir, remember Rojda Karen? She came, and one time she told us, we were always told that we are part Jewish, but we don't know any of the story. And I said, now I know where it came from. Because during this time in 2 Kings, it took place. So the next thing I want to talk about is a man named Zoroaster. Zoroaster, do I have a picture of him? I think so. Okay, that's him holding the celestial ball. Zoroaster lived about 1300 BC, and he was in Persia, in Iran. And he was not far, he was not so far from the nation of Israel and from the patriarchs in the area where this would have been in the time of Moses or maybe a little bit afterwards. He might have known some stories from Genesis, oral traditions. But in any case, he knew Zoroastrianism is a very interesting religion because it's not polytheistic. It is monotheistic. It's one of the few religions in the world that still worships Ahura Mazda, the great god in the sky, the most high god. And yet they get a lot of their theology wrong. They thought that it was that God wanted, they knew that God told them they have to work the ground, but somehow Zoroaster got mixed up and thought that if you eat an animal, you're sinning, and if you eat vegetables, you're not. And so he became a vegetarian. And so there's other things that he thought made people really like cannibalistic if they ate animals, that made them very evil. And so he got mixed up a little bit, but there was a lot of truth in what he did know. And what's so fascinating is that Zoroaster, in Persian, they call him Zarathustra. If you know 2001 Space Odyssey, the movie, and that great musical piece called Also Spoke Zarathustra, or So Spake Zoroaster, that's the same name. It's Wagner that wrote that concert was mentioning this man. Anyway, we have from his time a record of, I think it's 17 hymns or 17 prayers that he uttered. They go back to 1300 BC. And these prayers are fascinating because what Zoroaster prayed, and later on all the Persians became Zoroastrian. They thought he was really a man who was searching for Ahura Mazda, for the god of the sky, and he must know the best because they didn't have any scriptures. They didn't have Moses nearby to tell him, or even David or any of the kings. All they had to go by was what this man told them. And so he says this. This is one of his prayers. Your sacred fire, O Ahura, mighty through truth, most swift and powerful, may its helpful radiance be a bringer of joy to the good, but for the malicious wicked, may its power their evil disclose. So one thing that Zoroaster knew is that God was a God of fire. The fire represented God, but the mystery for him was how do you purge the wicked with your fire, but how do you protect the righteous? Because obviously you don't want to destroy all the righteous. He couldn't figure that out. But you know what happens? When Daniel gets placed from Judah all the way to Babylon, he writes a story that explains it. And it's about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Because they get thrown in the fire, and it's heated up 7 times hotter than normal, and the soldiers that put them in the fire, they get burned to death. It's so hot. And they're in there, and Nebuchadnezzar looks and says, what is going on? These men are walking around like nothing's happening in there. And there's a fourth man in there. Wasn't there just 3 that we threw in there? The fourth man looks like a son of the gods. There's your answer, Zoroaster. The same God who purges evil will protect with the same fire. He will protect the righteous. The second prayer was that he asked, this I ask thee, tell me truly, O Ahura, who shall be victorious and shall through thy principles protect the living? Assure me by a vision, whom dost thou wish to be the judge that heals the world? Who's going to be the judge at the end of time? Daniel answers that with another story of Belshazzar, who's taking the goblets of Nebuchadnezzar and drinking them with his friends and his concubines and 1,000 of his officials, and he says, hey, let's show the Jews that our God is bigger than theirs. We're going to take these beautiful goblets from Yahweh or Jehovah's temple, and we'll drink our wine from them, and that way we'll show our domination over them. And you remember the story that night, Daniel said, you're toast, right? Because the writing was on the wall. He sees this hand all by itself writing. This is a judge telling him, I've weighed you on the scales and you've been found wanting. You have no weight to you. Tzekel, tzekel, mina, mina, tzekel, uparsin. Meaning, a mina, you're not worth that. Shekel is 1/50th or 1/60th of a mina, you're not worth that. And farsi, or parson, is a half a shekel. You're not even worth that. Nothing, you have nothing to you. Time for you to give up your kingdom. And I'll read to you maybe in a little bit what happened. Well, I guess I can tell you now. The night that Belshazzar died, he was in Babylon. The Nebuchadnezzar was his grandfather. And here's his grandson. And Daniel's still alive. At this point, Daniel's like 80 years old. And Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, Belshazzar, thinks that because he's in Babylon, and Babylon was built so strong. Babylon was, I think there were 20 square miles there. No, I don't know how many square miles, but I know what it was. They had enough supplies for 20 years. We heard about Samaria. It took 3 years for the famine to start. For Babylon, it would take them 20 years to reduce those. Because part of the reason was because they had 2 walls. The inner wall was where the people lived, and the outer wall had plenty of farmland. So they could still farm. And the Euphrates went right through the middle of the city. They had 350 tons of water per second available. They could live for a long time. 20 years it would take for you. And you'll get to be an old man if you want to take this city, right? Well, what happened was, I explained in the book, Cyrus the Persian figured out a way to take the city. he decided, I'm going to wait until October when the Euphrates is so low that there's hardly any water left, because the Euphrates in February, March has, you know, whatever, 350 tons of water per second. And in October, August through October, it has 1/7 that. It's down to, you know, because that's the end of the dry season. And so he waited then, and he also found a tributary, an ancient tributary that was blocked, and he told his men, start digging this tributary out so that the water can go in there, and at the right time, we're going to open it up like a dam breaking, and then we're going to let the water out, and then the Euphrates will be even lower. So they waited until, I think it's October 16th or 17th, one of the mid-October. The Persian people, I mean, the Babylonians had their gods' festival on a particular night in October, and Cyrus knew they would all be drinking and stone drunk when he took over the city, and they would do it at midnight. So at about 10 o'clock that night, they heard him, you know, reveling inside, and they built all these fires that they had. I think they still do that today. The Kurds will jump over fires, and they had these fires that they were worshiping their god with. And anyway, and so he said, okay, open up that tributary. The Euphrates started pushing water out there, and then the Euphrates dropped so low that the men could come on the side, and they were up to their waist, and they could walk into the city. They walked in, and they began yelling at these men who were thinking, and at first they thought, oh, these guys are revelers like us, and they started killing them and knifing them and, you know, using their swords, and pretty soon, you know, one by one, block after block, they realized they'd been taken. It took 24 hours before the rest of the city even knew that they were taken. When they came to the palace, the guards were there in front of the palace. They were all drunk, too. They were celebrating. They had a big fire there. And so they acted like these soldiers from Cyrus, they acted like they were reveling with them and then stabbing them here and killing them there. And suddenly, that, you know, they heard this commotion. And the king, Belshazzar, was inside. Daniel had just predicted to him. He said, you are found wanting, and your kingdom will be given to someone else. And he didn't realize that within hours it would be taken, because it said that night Belshazzar was killed. And we don't know from Daniel, but we know from Herodotus, the Greek historian, how it happened. He said they came up, and Belshazzar heard noise outside. So he said, what's going on out there? Open the doors. And then, as soon as he opened the doors, they came in. And Belshazzar, all he could grab was his dagger, and they just got him right there. They heard, they met Daniel, and they realized within a few hours of what happened, that Daniel had been there, had predicted his death, and warned them that someone would take over, and they spared his life. And then Daniel became, in fact, the next almost prime minister to Darius the Mede. Because they realized Daniel predicted his departure and predicted us coming, you know. So it was very, very interesting to read that and realize how God changed history. Well, that's what the Medes had seen. Let me see what the next picture is. So this is Zoroaster. This is Daniel here. This is a picture of what Nebuchadnezzar might have looked like. And this is Cyrus, the one who took the city. And let me just go over here if I can see. I think what's so interesting about Cyrus, you might have heard about this, but Cyrus, even last week, you know, our president declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and that we would respect that. And then all these people started calling our president Cyrus. Why did they do that? Because Cyrus, this man here, is considered the first man to introduce something like democracy and human rights to the world. And if it weren't for this one little cylinder, this little 10-inch piece of pottery that was from about 1531 BC is when Cyrus took over Babylon. And we have a picture, I think, right here of this, what's called the Cyrus cylinder. Now, this is Persia. Let's see. There's Alexander the Great. There's Julius Caesar. I'll refer to that in a little bit. Let me see if I can find. Where's the Cyrus cylinder? I guess I don't have it there. Unless it's over after this one. There's Nebuchadnezzar. All these. There's Babylon. Here it is right there. There's a Cyrus cylinder. It looks really big in this picture, but actually it's only about 10 or 11 inches long, and they one time had it at the Getty for people to see. And when they had it at the Getty, they had 250,000 visitors looking just for this thing here. Mr. Hormuz found it back in 1940 or 1950. He found it in one of the Iraqi digs that they had, and he picked up the cylinder and said, what is this? So they brought it to some Sumerian scholars that read, this is all what they call them. What is this called? I gotta know it. It's Sumerian script. What is it called? It's with these nails. They use nails and they do the whole thing. But anyway, it'll come back to me. And this is a portion of that cylinder, and they had it translated, and they realized this was Cyrus's proclamation to all the 120 nations that he took over. Once you took over Babylon, you had the entire region was yours. He was the emperor, right? And so this is, I'm going to quote to you some of the things he said. He said this, I sent back to their places the sanctuaries across the river Tigris, whose shrines had earlier become dilapidated, the gods who lived therein and made permanent sanctuaries for them. I collected together all their people and returned them to their settlements. I returned them unharmed to their cells and in their sanctuaries that make them happy. That is the gods. So what happened was he had like all these different people groups that were part of the kingdom. But during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, he destroyed all the other people's gods, including Jerusalem, including the temple, right? He did not want people worshiping Jehovah. He did not want other ones worshiping Marduk or whoever their gods were. And so he made them from all those nations. He brought the royalty back to Babylon and he centralized everything and said, from now on, you're going to worship my God and my God only. That's why he had that statue, remember? He said, here's a statue. Anyone who doesn't bow down when the music starts, you're going to be burned in this fire. And so it was probably a statue of himself. He was probably, you know, like, I'm God now and you'll worship me and my God or his favorite God. I think it was Marduk. I can't remember right now. But anyway, when Cyrus took over, he said, I'm going to send all these people back to their homelands and I'm going to rebuild the sanctuaries of every national god. So they can all have their own sanctuary. And guess what? That included who? The Jews. Cyrus gave permission for the Jews to go back. It just so happened that the Jewish God was Jehovah. But just like the other freedoms that he gave, he said, you're welcome to build your temple back to Jehovah. And here's some money. Here's some timber. Here's all the gold and silver goblets that were taken from Nebuchadnezzar. I'm giving them back to you. And you take them and pray for me and pray to your God for me. So even though he didn't know Jehovah God, he actually got the benefit by giving everyone permission to go back to their homeland and build all these sanctuaries. He got permit. I mean, he gave the blessing of the Jews going back and building their sanctuary too. So he said, I collected together all the people and returned them to their settlements. I returned them unharmed to their cells. May all the gods that I returned to their sanctuaries ask for a long life for me and mention my good deeds. I have enabled all the lands to live in peace. And then he says really something very interesting. Let's see. He talks about the great Lord who nurtures his people, saw with pleasure. God, Ahura Mazda, he had Cyrus taken the road to Tintir, which is Babylon, and like a friend and companion, God walked at his side. He's talking in the third person here. His vast troops, whose number, like the water in a river, could not be counted, marched fully arrived at his side. He had him enter, that is, God had him enter Babylon without fighting or battle, right into Shuana, which is Babylon. He saved his city, Babylon, from hardship. He handed over to him Nebuchadnezzar, the king, who did not fear him. Nebuchadnezzar was the father of Belshazzar. The Lord, and then, so that, I'm reading that because I want you to know that Cyrus himself wrote that when it came time to take over Babylon, he said it was like a miracle. I got in there without any effort at all. I didn't have to have a fight. The third city that the city that he got before Babylon, he had to fight, and it was a bloody massacre of the civilians. But by the time he came to Babylon, because of this ingenious plan that he had to go through the Euphrates, he got in without any fight, except those, you know, the few guards that were there. And so he credits that to his God in the heaven, the God who watched over him and took him there. Now here's the interesting thing. When you read Isaiah, and what Isaiah says about Cyrus, the same individual, you see it from God's perspective. Okay, Cyrus doesn't know Jehovah. He just knows that some God up there gave him permission to go and take Babylon, and after that, he wanted to be good to the people and let them all go back to their sanctuaries. But here's what Isaiah says. The Lord says to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held, to subdue nations before him, to strip kings of their armor, to open the doors before him, and the gates shall not be shut. Quote, I will go before you and make the rough places smooth. I will break the doors of brass in pieces and cut apart the bars of iron. I will give you the treasures of darkness and hidden riches of secret places, that you may know that it is I, Jehovah, who call you by your name, even the God of Israel. For Jacob, my servant's sake, and Israel, my chosen, I have called you by your name. I have given you a title, though you have not known me. So God, this is important that for us to see that God had complete charge over this man, Cyrus, even though Cyrus did not personally know him. And that's why whenever you see things happen in history, bad or good or bad, or, you know, things, you know, political things, don't be afraid because God is in charge. Even of the most godless king or the most godless president or the most godless law that's passed, God is in charge. He knows what's happening. He appointed for this to take place. And that's why when it's his time, he can reverse things, you know. For Jacob, my servant's sake, and Israel, my chosen, I have called you. I am the Lord, and there is no one else besides me. There is no God. I will strengthen you, Cyrus, though you have not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is no one besides me. I am the Lord, and there is no one else. Rain, you heavens from above, and let the skies pour down righteousness. So that is Isaiah's take on the man Cyrus. If I had more time, I would read to you in detail the dream that takes place. But what I want to say is this, that Daniel, in Daniel's time, this is when Nebuchadnezzar was reigning, and then after Nebuchadnezzar died, then Nabonidus, and then after Nabonidus came Belshazzar, and Daniel's life was so long. He was probably 17 years old, 18, when he was taken from Jerusalem, and he lived to be in his 90s, partly because he was probably a eunuch. They probably castrated him, which means he could last longer, he could live longer. But he was a man whom God chose to live through three complete or four different administrations. By the time he was there, he was still around at Darius the Persian, Cyrus the Persian. During that time, he was still there, and that's when we have the Daniel in the lion's den. Remember that Darius wanted to protect him, and the men were against him. So Daniel spanned these four kingdoms or four different reigns, and all the time he was speaking the truth. And he chose, as I've mentioned to you before, he chose to write his book in two languages. So the first chapter of Daniel is in Hebrew. Chapters 2 through 7 is in Aramaic, the Gentile language. And then 8 through 12 is Hebrew again, like an Oreo cookie, right? So the white part of the Oreo, that was God's gift to the Gentiles, Aramaic, their language. They could read it, they could memorize it, they could understand it. And that starts with the words, hail to the king, or may the king live forever. And these, it says in Aramaic, King Nebuchadnezzar, you had this dream. There's going to be four kingdoms. You're the first one. After you will come another one, and then a third one. And finally, there will be a kingdom as strong as iron, just like this statue shows, the head of gold, the breastplate of silver, the thighs of bronze, and then finally, the legs of iron. And those represented Babylon, Medo-Persia, Alexander the Great, and Macedonia or Greece, and finally, Rome. And so, as I mentioned in the book, you'll see a timeline that the Medes and the Kurds of that time, the Magi tribe, the Magi tribe. It says, Herodotus says that at the time of Cyrus, there were six Median tribes. And he mentions them. I can't remember the names, but the last name he mentions is the Magian tribe, the Magi. The Kurds themselves call themselves Manji or Manji, which is the same root. They just add an N in there, Magi, Manji. And they have a saying called Lawi Manji Chu Kazenji, which means, oh, this man claims to be a Manji from the special tribe, and he thinks he's going to prosper in everything he does just because he's a Manji, you know, because it was kind of a status symbol to be Manji or Manji. And do you know that today the Kurds still speak a language called, where I lived in Diyarbakir, they speak Kur Manji. Kur is like the son of the word son, and Manji is Magi. So the people who speak Kurdish, Kur Manji Kurdish, are probably those who came from the Magi family, from the Magi priestly tribe. And interestingly, the dialect next to the Kurmanji people are called the Bahdinani. Bahdin means the layman. So here's the priestly tribe, the Magi, the Zoroastrian priests, and here's the layman right here, the faithful layman, the Bahdin. So Bahdinani, Kurmanji are probably echoes, distant echoes of the past when we had the Magi tribe living in southeastern Turkey, north of Diyarbakir, north there, and then the Bahdini tribe, which is north Iraq, over by a little bit more eastward. So my point in saying this is this, that in Daniel's time, when he wrote these six chapters in Aramaic, he was giving a gift, a personalized Bible for the Medo-Persian people in their own language, for all the Gentiles. Because the whole Gentile world knew Aramaic, it was the trade language, so they could all read it. Even though they didn't know Hebrew, they did know Aramaic. So when they read about this dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, they were given a blueprint of human history before it took place. Because Nebuchadnezzar had his dream right near the beginning of his reign. Just 3 or 4 years after Daniel was there, he had this dream. And Daniel says, you know what? There's going to be four great kingdoms. And in the years of the fourth kingdom, then there will be this rock from heaven that comes down. It's going to smash the statue. And the statue will be pulverized into powder. It'll be taken, carried up by the wind. And it will exist no more. And all that happens is this rock, a supernatural rock, is going to grow into a mountain. And then that's the end of time. So what we have in Daniel chapter 2 is a blueprint of human history before it ever takes place. And the rock is called a supernatural. It's cut out without human hands. He was born of a virgin, right? He did not have a human father. This king would take over the world. And so the Magi, the Manji tribe, They could see from Daniel's writings, whatever they may have had from Zoroaster, from Zarathustra, they knew that Daniel had the answers, because I mentioned the one thing about fire, the second thing was the judge, and the third question, or the third prayer, the third wish that Zoroaster had is, how do we get immortality? How will we live forever, Ahura Mazda? And he didn't know the answer, but Daniel gave it in chapter 7. He says, the way you live forever is to align yourself with the Son of Man. Because at the end of time, the Ancient of Days will be sitting on a throne, and then the Son of Man will be brought before him, and all the kingdoms of the world will be given to him, and all his holy ones, his saints, or those who align themselves with him, those who believe in him, they will reign with the Son of Man forever and ever. And he says that 6 times. He mentions the holy ones. So the Magi knew 3 things. What Daniel has told us has answered the questions we've had for 800 years about our religious man Zoroaster and his views. Now we understand what it is. It's this Son of Man, this one man who's going to take over the world, and he will protect us from fire, and he will let us live forever with him, and he will be the judge of mankind. He's the one that God appointed to judge every living person. So as they're checking off history, they realize, okay, Cyrus is now the king. That's the second, where the point of the silver. And then 200 years later in 331 BC, guess who takes over the world? Alexander comes in, takes over Jerusalem, takes over, you know, all the way to Babylon, all the way to the Indus River. So Alexander, at age 31, 32, he's a very young man. He takes over the world. Then he dies. But then they realize, okay, this is the third one. This is the great, the bronze. And then in 44 BC, Julius Caesar is killed. And when he's assassinated, it's right after he took over the Mediterranean. And here is the new clad of iron, these legs of iron, because Rome ruled like an iron scepter over the nations. They said, that's it. 44. Now we're in 44 BC. Sometime, any time now, we should see a rock come from heaven. Let me show you what it looks like when you see a comet. I don't know if I have it here or later on. I think the comet was before then. Okay. So when you look at a comet, it looks a lot like a rock falling from heaven. There it is. There's the Lovejoy comet. But if the Magi saw a comet, there's a book that I have given to me by Carol Davis called The Christ Comet. And the author shows in vivid detail, he's taken apart the whole references of Matthew and other places, and he says, I'm confident that it was a comet that came, and that was the real star. Because a comet would have stayed in the sky for several months, and it could have guided them enough time. And then when they saw it on the horizon, it would have been right over the place where Mary and Joseph were. They could have followed that. And it looks like a rock coming from heaven. Look, just like it. Just like what Nebuchadnezzar's dream said. This rock will come, a supernatural rock, and it will take over the world. So when they saw that, whether it was a comet or not, I don't know, but somehow they knew this was a sign of that man we read about in these 6 chapters of Daniel. And what do? They do what any normal Middle Eastern person does. You get the most expensive gift you can come up with, and you hightail to that king, and you walk over to him, and you bow down, and you kiss his feet, and you say, I believe you're going to be in charge of this whole region, and I just want to be the first to align myself to you. I want you to know I have obeyed you. I have sworn allegiance to you. You are my king because I believe in you. So this was a political / faith move. It wasn't just faith. It was like, whoa, this is the one that's going to take over the world. We got to get ourselves right with this guy, because unlike Nebuchadnezzar, unlike Cyrus and Darius, unlike Alexander the Great, unlike Julius Caesar and the Romans, this one, his kingdom will never end. And he's going to go much farther than 120 provinces. He's going to take over the rest of the world. And if we align ourselves to him, he will let us reign with him. He's going to give us promotions. Do you realize that every single story from 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, every single 7, all 6 chapters there, ends with a promotion. It ends with someone trusting God and then getting promoted. So in the beginning, Daniel is promoted. He's literally, Nebuchadnezzar falls at his face, burns incense, and worships Daniel because of the ability to interpret the dream. The next thing, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're thrown into the fire, and then when he comes out, he says, you, I'm going to be put in charge. And he made them prosper in his reign. They were promoted. The third one is a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and he himself confesses, I was so arrogant, I thought I was the one in charge of Babylon, and I'd built it, and then God turned me into a cattle, something like a cow out there for 7 years. And when I came back to my senses, I said, God, I'm so sorry, you're the one who's in charge of history. And guess who gets promoted? Nebuchadnezzar himself is promoted at the end. He said, now, then after that, all the men sought my wisdom again, and God gave me my reign back and gave me excessive joy and honor. And then the fifth one, Belshazzar's feast, he asked Daniel, "What can you interpret these writings, the Menemene Tekel Upharsin?" He did, and he said, "Okay, I'll make you third ruler," because Nabonidus, his father, was in charge, and he was second, and Daniel would have been third. He was promoted. And then after Daniel in the lion's den, he was promoted again. Daniel was promoted to the vice-regent. And finally, the last person to be promoted was the Son of Man. Because the Son of Man was attacked by the beast. You'll see it in chapter 7. The beast was saying awful, blasphemous things. And then it says, the beast was thrown into the lake of fire, and the Son of Man was brought before the Ancient of Days, and to him was given every kingdom on earth. Promotion, promotion, promotion. So these men, the Magi knew, if we align ourselves with this rock from the beginning to the end, we see that this man is in charge. Because it was Jesus who entered every single story. At first, he's the rock. In the second story with Shadrach and Meshach, he was the Son of God, right? Inside. He says, "I see someone like the Son of the Gods." That was Jesus. The third story, the watcher from heaven comes down and says, "Time out, you're going to become like a cow." That watcher says, the watchers gave a decree. And that angel was no normal angel. That was Jesus giving his decree. It's time for you to be gone and someone else to take over. The next story is, Belshazzar, then comes Daniel in the lion's den. Then comes Belshazzar, and then he's the judge, the hand, the writing of the wall. That's Jesus again. And then in Daniel 6, when he's thrown into the lion's den, he is the messenger from God coming to protect him from the lions. And lastly, he's the Son of Man. So there's a different phrase used, but this is I believe it's the pre-incarnate Christ coming to show the reader that he's the one who actually changes history. He's the one who's in charge. He takes up one king or deposes that king and brings this man over and puts him in his place. He can change them like puppets because he's in charge of history. And you cannot stop him. You may have a wall eight chariot stick like Babylon or whatever, and you may have the Euphrates River running through, but he'll find a way to change it and dethrone you and put someone else in charge. It'll be a miracle, but he'll do it because he's the one who has charge of history. He's the judge of all mankind. So I say this to say that when it came finally time for them to come to Bethlehem, all these things happened that they read about, these stories, and they knew about how miraculous it was that Cyrus took over. And then Alexander the Great even felt like it was a supernatural thing. And here they are, the Magi. And this, I like this painting because it shows that there were more than just three. There was probably 20 or 30 of them. It was a whole entourage of men who came with all this money, this gifts, to show Mary and Joseph and to say, basically, you tell your little 18-month-old boy when he gets older that the Magi tribe, the Magoi in Greek, we came here and we have aligned ourselves with him. So one day, so what happens? God answers their prayer. About 30 years later, 35 years later, we have the day of Pentecost. And guess who showed up at Pentecost? Luke says, "Behold, aren't there these people who are speaking Galileans? How do we hear everyone in our own native language? Parthians, Medes." Oh my goodness. Sons of Madai are right there at Pentecost. What are you doing here? You belong back in Persia. Well, just what happens is we're part Jewish and we feel like Pentecost was a time where you could come down and worship the God of the Jews and Elamites, people from Mesopotamia. There's Parthians, Medes, Elamites, Mesopotamia. Those are all part of Iran and part of Iraq and part of Turkey. And those are the people who came. Just that same DNA that I read to you, that study from the Hebrew University, the same people group. And they're there worshiping God. And then they hear from Peter the sermon. Peter says, "You know what? This is the time of the Holy Spirit. Today marks the church age and welcome to the Church of Jesus Christ here in Jerusalem." And they stay there for months. And they joined the people, they had food together, and they went back and they were believers. So God answered the prayers of the Magi. The Magi went there, they worshipped him. They were the first non-Jewish people to recognize that he was the Savior. And even the Pharisees in Jerusalem, 11 or 14 miles away, didn't even dawn on them, go to Bethlehem and find him. They had no interest in the Messiah. But these men came on a 3-month journey to make sure they did not miss this event. They did not miss the chance to give him the most expensive things they could come up with and say, "We will align our lives with you." They risked their lives. They were almost killed on the way home because Herod wanted them dead. It didn't matter. They wanted to know that one day they would reign with the King of Kings. It had nothing to do with astrology. It had everything to do with Daniel's prophecies. They're all there, written in their own language. They had it for 500 years. They had memorized this. They knew exactly what was happening because they could see history happen just like Daniel had predicted. So they were not about to miss this chance. That is the story of the Magi. And it doesn't end there. We have John at the end of time saying in Revelation, the same city of Babylon. Remember I told you before, there's only two cities in Scripture that mean that have a great significance. One is Jerusalem and one is Babylon. Jerusalem is where they built a temple to honor God. Babylon, they built a tower to defy God, right? Here they're calling God to come down and bless them. Here they're defying God, saying, we'll have nothing to do with you. We're going to have our own kingdom. And so here, God scatters them and confuses their language. And in Jerusalem, he unites them. And suddenly, all these people from different parts of the world can understand each other. A miracle. Why? Because the Spirit came down to that which was the temple, to those people who were inviting him to come and praying. And God just says, I'm going to destroy this thing, your tower of pride. And John says, fallen, fallen. Finally the day will come where Babylon the Great, the kings of the earth who committed sexual immorality with her and the merchants of the earth, they grew rich from the abundance of her luxury. And he says, come out of her, my people, that you will not participate in her sins, that you don't receive some of her plagues, for her sins have reached to the sky, and God has remembered her iniquities. Return to her just as she returned, and repay her double for all she did according to her works. And it says here, after these things, I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no man could count, out of every nation and all tribes, peoples, languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, dressed in white robes with palm branches in their hands. There will be people from Mexico. There will be people from Central America. There will be people from South America. There will be people from North America. There will be people from Europe. There will be people from Africa. There will be people from Asia, from all over the world. And there will be Manji. There will be Kurds and Medes and Persians who are there worshiping the sun, because John says before the end of time, he will take people from every single language group that we know of, 4,800 languages, and they're all going to be there. There will be a church in every one of them, or God is not God. Why? Because the rock would grow and take over the entire world. There's not one corner of the earth that Jesus will not reign over, every single tribe. And so I end the book with this epilogue. Secular history records the struggle for power and the rise and fall of political kingdoms, but sacred history records the power of God ruling over the affairs of man. Since the beginning of civilization, the Kurds and Persians have witnessed some of the greatest manifestations of God's sovereign rule throughout history, including the remains of Noah's Ark, right? Mount Ararat. The scattering of the nations after the Tower of Babel, that took place in North Iraq. The conquest of Babylon, when Cyrus came in. The fulfillment of Daniel's prophecies. The rise of Queen Esther, she was married to the Persian king, Ahasuerus. The commission of Ezra, the priest. The star leading to Bethlehem. Daniel's Aramaic verses, which represented only 1% of God's revelation, provided them with a written message from God in their own language, a Bible just for them. Even though the crumbs, Jesus said, the crumbs that fall from the table, the children get the bread, but the crumbs were enough to save that Syrophoenician woman's daughter. And so these crumbs from the Old Testament are enough to save the Gentiles. It's only 1%, but it's enough. They no doubt studied it carefully, and they staked their future on his promises concerning the Son of Man. And as a result, many of their people found salvation as they traveled to Judea to meet the King of Kings. And tragically, today, for many Kurds and Persians, the account of these events has been forgotten in their history. They don't even know it. I tell them the story, they've never heard it before. All that has remained is a sad tale of wars between nations, tribes, clans, and families. But now, as we contemplate the story of Jesus of Nazareth and all the promises that were made concerning him, from the moment Eve heard that one of her descendants would crush the head of the serpent to the day Jesus was raised from the dead and declared to be the eternal Son of God, we recognize that human history is culminated in the person of Christ. When the end comes, everything will be made right. The gate to paradise will once again be open. The sentence of death will no longer hang over our heads. There won't be any cancer. There won't be any need for prayer. Our bodies will be perfect. We will no longer seek to be autonomous from God, but we will rejoice in worshiping him. God will humble the proud and exalt the humble. He will save those who trusted him and judge those who defied him. While all the empires and kingdoms of the world sit in ashes and ruins, the Son of Man will sit down at the right hand of his Father, and his kingdom will never end. In the New Jerusalem, there will be no more brutal dictators. No more tears will be shed. No evil will be allowed. Although we all might come from different nations and languages, in heaven we will understand each other and live in perfect harmony. The longing of Zoroaster and of all mankind that we would live eternally will be given to us. May that day come soon. Amen. Let's pray. I thank you, Father, for the history of your word, for all these things that took place that so many people don't even know about. We just see a picture of three men carrying gifts, and we think this was some legend from way old. But Lord, it really happened. There were really people that went there in Bethlehem. And they had studied the scriptures, and it led them all the way to the Savior. And they completely aligned themselves with this man and staked their lives on it. So help us today, Lord, to stake our lives on the Son of Man, this person who will reign forever. And if we believe in him and trust our lives to him, give him gifts, kiss his feet, and swear allegiance to him, then one day we will also reign with him. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.